You are listening to AE Sci-Fi, the Canadian Science Fiction Review. I'm Paul Jarvie, and I'm here with Duff McCourt and Helen Michaud to share three of our favorite stories from the past year. I hope that you enjoy them as much as we have. The first of these is This Is Not What I Wanted for My Birthday by Rati Mehrotra.
No, Henry. This is not what I wanted for my birthday. When will you learn? 30 years. 30 years I've been trying to make you listen to me. Okay, fine. I won't start. But you do realize I asked for a Gen 14 Lab-O-Matic. They hatch into these cute little puppy things that clean the floor and fetch your slippers for you. Every loneliness mitigation center in Toronto has one. Even that awful Dr. D'Souza woman next door has one. And she's always going on about it. No, this is not a Gen 14 Lab-O-Matic. This is a Gen 4 Lynx-O-Matic. It says so right on the box, quite clearly. Look, I don't think they even make these anymore. The size of the egg should have given you a clue. No, even if you didn't bother reading what you were buying, you'd better return this to the store before it hatches. What do you mean you can't? It was on final sale? You are so cheap. My 50th birthday and you can't even splurge a little? Oh, shoot. The egg's cracking. Do we have a cage? No? Okay. Just put it in the box. Maybe that'll contain it for a little while. Hold it down. I'm calling the 800 number right now. I don't care if the box is shaking. Just hold it down. No one's picking up the phone. I'm just getting a recorded message on their store closing sale. They're probably delighted to get a hold of a sucker like you that would actually buy a discontinued item. Henry, I told you, hold the box down. Oh, look, you've gone and let it escape. No, I didn't see how big it was. I was looking at the phone, remember? Stop blubbering. It's just a little scratch. You're fine. Be thankful it's nothing worse. Here, I'll grab the first aid kit. Oh, I hope you're satisfied. Instead of drinking wine and opening presents, here I am dabbing cream and tying bandages around your thick neck. Of course it wasn't going for your jugular. Don't be ridiculous. How should I know where it went? It's probably lurking somewhere behind the sofa or the cabinet, waiting to leap out at us when we're not looking. No. There's no way we're calling RoboControl. Do you have any idea how much that costs? Besides, we'd never live it down. We'll just have to find it, catch it ourselves. I don't even know what it eats. God's nails! Did you see that? That orange monstrosity just went streaking out the window. Come on, see if we can spot it. Okay, if it's gone from our premises, it's no longer our responsibility. We'll just close the doors, close the windows, report it missing, and never worry about it again. Maybe we can get $50 off the latest Lab-O-Matic or something. Oh, there it is. I see it. It's over there in D'Souza's garden. It's wrecking the rose bushes she's always boasting about. Oh, I can't believe this. That dumb Lab-O-Matic of hers. It's actually attacking it. It's like a ball of fluff attacking a tiger. Oh, they don't make those Lab-O-Matics very resilient, do they? Look at all that wire and stuffing. Cutting corners, I guess. Maybe it's a good thing you didn't buy one. Oh, here comes D'Souza herself. Doesn't she look mad? Draw the curtains a bit so she doesn't see us. Lynx-O-Matic is snarling at her. This is so funny. I've never seen her run before. I'm amazed she can run with all that fat weighing her down. Oh, that wasn't such a bad gift after all, Henry. This is the best. I haven't enjoyed myself so much in ages. Oh, look, it's coming back this way. Isn't that sweet? Henry, where are you? Henry? It's no good hiding, I tell you. Look, go find out what Lynx-O-Matics eat.
The Winnipeg Kid by Ken Gerber and Brian Hurt. Johnny Golden's blonde ringlets are slick with sweat and blood. His blue eyes, beautiful, almost feminine, swell with tears. The sclera of his left is beet red from a burst vessel. Those eyes are among the few parts of him that can move, and they dart around in fear. I have him in a death grip. He knows it. I know it. 60-odd thousand paying, stomping, ululating fans know it. Our projected images tower over the crowd. Our flexing muscles and soiled weapons and sweat and blood rendered in oversized three-dimensional detail. And while well-padded men still slash at each other with crooked sticks down the highway, Hockey is a ghost of its former glory. Sports Night in the Americas now demands its champions to arm themselves with steel. An Olympic stadium is Montreal's Coliseum. The nosebleed seats offer just as good a view of the outside spectacle as the front row, and they're just as pricey, too. Technology has been kind, indeed, to the blood sports. Johnny Golden is on his back. My knee presses into his solar plexus, and I hold his straight-jacketed arms in an iron grip. Even bent on one knee, my projection towers above the top row of seats. Johnny's eyes are wide. He expects he's a dead man. He's been thrown into combat with me, and I'm the meat grinder, the widowmaker, the last person you ever look at. I'm the Winnipeg Kid. And they only let me fight the expendable ones anymore. I lean toward Johnny, and an expectant hush falls over the crowd. The sound of thousands of lips licking. The crowd knows what's coming. I lean in. Lightly, very lightly, I place my lips on Johnny's forehead. And in that moment, I see, I know. Johnny Golden, John Haxon. Father was a neighbor from two floors above, fact unknown to both men. Mother failed two attempts at self-induced abortion. John, age 2, mother incarcerated for violent drug crimes, now dead. John, age 10, first stint in juvenile detention, most fight training behind bars. John, aged 11, pimped out by foster parents, murders both, suspected but never arrested. John, age 15, legally emancipated. John, age 18, refused entry into the United States Army based on psychological screening and criminal record. John, aged 19, adopts Johnny Golden and joins the league. John today, age 20, record of 3-1, resuscitated from one defeat and one victory, unemployable outside the profession. Loved by none. Will be missed by none. My gift. I am, when needed, the sword of justice. And I am, when needed, the angel of death. For Johnny, I'm the latter. Death will be a mercy. I grant it. I pull his arms even tighter behind his spine, and Johnny arcs his back in agony, exposing the sweet pink of his neck. I release one hand, but before Johnny can respond, it is at his neck. I tear at his exposed artery with fingers like iron. I dig, pulling the life from his neck by the handful. Virtual blood sprays out of the dome of the once again open stadium to the very extremes of the massive projectors, and the illusion crackles off into the damp Montreal night. The crowd convulses in a spasm of murderous rapture. Actual blood sprays on me, hot and tangy, details the crowd will never appreciate. Johnny is a limp side of beef. I let him fall to the mat. This is a death that the league doctors cannot reverse. My signature moves all mean the same thing. Resuscitation is impossible. I rise to the ovation. They whisk me off to the locker room while cheerleaders fornicate during the first intermission. I'm not done for the night. The winner of the first bout fights the last, but it won't take much to prep me for the finale. I'm the Winnipeg Kid, and I'm always ready for a fight. Dr. Steve, reeking of bleach, ambles in with not a bit of urgency. There's no rush. I'm not dead, and Johnny Golden is, permanently. He attends to the dead man first, and I jibe. I think his blood pressure's a little low, Doc. Still inspecting, he says with a mirthless chuckle, low but stable, kid. Dr. Steve fills out his lab coat impressively, the starched white now stained with Johnny's blood, and he looks like he could be one of us. If you ask me, I say Johnny Golden's better off. Mm-hmm, he says, without looking up from the gaping neck and mangled jugular, possibly entertaining some wishful notion that it could put the poor bastard back together. Sorry, Doc, this one is drained out and used up. I wonder what he's hiding behind that carefully lowered brow. Revulsion? Fear, maybe? I could find out, but I don't dare. I nearly bestowed my gift on him years ago. It was after one of my early fights, a rare loss. I was in bad shape, but I hadn't died. I remember, as I lay on my back, the world spinning around me, the singular smell of doctor's bleach snapped me into momentary sharpness. Dr. Steve was above me, a needle in one hand. I didn't even mean to. It was an instinct. I grabbed him with my iron grip, and I pulled him close. He fumbled the syringe. A nurse tried uselessly to pull me away, and I laid a kiss between Dr. Steve's eyes. Then I saw inside him, outside him, Steve Lavery, M.D., born in Ottawa to Louise Silber and Richard Lavery. Stephen, age 5, enters private kindergarten. Stephen, age 7, first taste of scotch at his grandparents' winter retreat. But no more than that. Instead, suddenly, darkness. A needle, maybe Dr. Steve's, maybe a nurse's, must have found my flesh, and a soporific flooded my veins. I never learned the rest of Dr. Steve's testimony. Whatever fitting end he deserved, that interruption had saved him, and we both know it. That needle saved me, too. I'm allowed to kill certain employees of the League, allowed and encouraged. That's my job. But League doctors are not among them. Society would have judged any sentence I passed on Dr. Steve that night long ago as murder. Far better that I didn't have the chance. A roar from the stadium shakes the locker room, breaking my reverie. Dr. Steve is done with Johnny Golden, and he is ready to suture for me. I haven't even realized until now that among Johnny's final acts were a pair of gashes in my left cheek and left biceps. Dr. Steve turns my head to the side, and his gloved hands probe my wound. Suddenly, his face is close to mine. Someday, doctor. Someday. 4 referees fly in with a stretcher, and now Dr. Steve has real work to do. I recognize the hapless gladiator. This gargantuan beast, carpeted in his own natural shag, is bare rock. He lies on the gurney with eyes wide open but rolled back out of sight. Cardiac arrest, barks one of the refs. Shit, says Dr. Steve, examining Bear Brock's torso. What the hell happened to him? He just got a dozen heavy punches to the chest from Column Joe, says the ref. Dr. Steve shakes his head and reaches for the defibrillator. When it's over and Dr. Steve is cleaned up, he returns to finish the stitching job on me. Is he going to fight again? He was only dead 15 minutes. He'll live, he says, off to the side of me. I doubt he'll fight again, though, unless the League springs for a new heart, in which case he won't be fighting you anytime soon. Can't throw away an investment like that too quickly. Dr. Steve yanks off his gloves with a pop, scribbles something onto a screen, and leaves the break room without saying a word. He looks as cheerless as ever. It can't be easy keeping up with the Winnipeg Kid. The evening's finale. His name is Deadeye Dorado. I know the book on this character. He wears a quaint lucha libre mask, painted like a skull, black and fluorescent yellow, but the eyes are filmed over with reflective lenses. The first bell rings and the projector turns on, 2 virtual juggernauts towering over the crowd. They see us in every detail. We don't see them at all. The second bell rings and our dance begins. The sound of the crowd fades into a faraway whine, drowned out by the hammering heartbeats in my ears. Weapons flash. Deadeye draws first blood at 3 minutes into the fight, slicing down the fleshy part of my right forearm. The pain is an annoyance. I return the favor with a jab under his ribs just a second later, and so on. We're contractually obligated to let this go 10 minutes. After that, the real fight starts. I am surprised at a few ticks past 600 seconds to learn what a good fighter Deadeye is. Faster, suddenly, stronger, smarter. Flash, my left thumb is gone, flying into the night sky. I hear the crowd's lusty enthusiasm. It's nothing the doctors can't fix, not even the thumb of my death grip hand. But still, he's outmaneuvering me, overpowering me. Flash, my left ear, gone. I think this is not the book on this guy. And then I think he's been sandbagging it in his previous fights, feigning ineptness. It makes no sense. A blow to my face, too fast to defend. I cough and swallow something in a gulp of blood. I stumble, and at last I'm pinned to the blood-slick mat. Deadeye is lighter than me, but he has me pinned with his knees in just one hand. His blade in the other, but he tosses it away. It flies out of the ring. The crowd approves. With his free hand, Deadeye reaches for my mouth. I bite at him and notice only now that my incisors have gone missing. That's what I'd swallowed just minutes ago. He pinches the loose flesh of my mouth, and my lips pucker despite my protest. He lowers his own forehead to my lips. I strain to move away, but he holds my head in place. Against my will, I place a bloody kiss on the forehead of the fighting mask, right above those impenetrable reflective lenses. The Winnipeg Kid, Carol Klingman, born in Winkler, Manitoba, son of Carol Sr. and Mother Anne. No, this isn't how it works. I twist and struggle uselessly. Deadeye holds my face in an iron grip of his own. Carol, age 7, learns his gift at the deathbed of a maternal grandmother dying of cancer. Euthanizes her. No. Carol, aged 11, passes sentence on his wrestling coach. No, this is all wrong. Carol, aged 17, euthanizes father, euthanizes mother. Carol, aged 18, joins the league. Carol, aged 19, dies in battle for the first time, fights again 4 days later. Carol today, age 33, 216 mercy killings to date, 80 executions, a handful that were both. Carol tonight, now, surrounded now by a crowd of thousands, they scream for him with a passion fueled by revulsion and fascination. The Winnipeg kid, willing to act out the murderous fantasies of the timid masses. Not a sword of justice. Not an angel. A monster. The crowd does not love him. They will miss the killing. But they will not miss him. Deadeye's gift. He pulls his own forehead away from my lips and releases my jaw. His hand now freed, he reaches for my throat. In the fleeting moment, I wonder if this death will be one that Dr. Steve can reverse. And I pray not.
The Trial of the Beekeeper by Siobhan Hoad. There was a huge clump of bees at the end of my driveway. That in itself wasn't reason enough for me to run towards them. They'd swarmed before, but the ever-so-familiar pair of pink Doc Martens protruding from the clump was. Shit. I hadn't seen Ellen since our last screaming match, but there were her boots, lying in my driveway. As I knelt beside them, the bees took off, hovering over my head and exposing the body that lay beneath them. It was Ellen, all right. The short red hair, those boots, and one of her usual flowery dresses. She was cold. The hum from the bees' wings was loud enough to be a shout. I stood up. I needed to call the police, or maybe her mother. The bees buzzed louder and circled my head, all of them in unison. That was weird. And once I thought about it, it was weird that they'd been all over Ellen. Unless she was drenched in sugar water, they just shouldn't be that interested. The bees stilled in front of my face and began separating. They'd spelled out my entire name before I realized I was looking at letters. The whole message read, "Jim, it's Ellen, fuck you." And that's when they started stinging me. Honeybees don't sting at random. Each one dies once it uses its stinger, so they have to feel very mad or threatened. But once they do sting and die, a chemical is released that signals to all the other bees to sting in the same place. This kind of explains why I was stung 25 times in the face, mostly around the eyes, but nowhere else. Still, when it was time for me to be released from the hospital, I phoned my friend Benjamin and asked him to bring me my beekeeping gear. He was nice enough not to ask me any questions, and he and Ellen had been in a few art classes together, so I figured he'd be safe, just in case. "Are you training your bees to join the circus or something?" he asked when he came to pick me up. "Something like that. Why, were they doing something strange?" "Well, it kind of looked like a lot of them were flying around in formation spelling out, cocksucker." "Oh." I dressed in my beekeeping suit. First the white shirt, tucked into the white elastic waist pants and gloves to my elbows. Then the stiff hat with a veil hanging over it that drawstrings shut at the bottom. The layers keep the bees from getting to your skin, and everything's white to help you seem invisible. Bees see a different color spectrum, more ultraviolet than us humans. Benjamin dropped me off at the edge of my driveway. When I stepped out of the car, the bees were spelling, "Cast out the drone." Ellen had said that the honeybee's practice of kicking all the male drones out of the hive for winter was sexist, but that she could see their point. The female workers were the ones who fetched all the nectar. The drones just ate and waited to mate with the queen. They were dead weight. I was dead weight. Wasn't that why we'd broken up? I shook my head. I needed to focus if I wanted to sneak past the swarm. I lit my burlap rag and dropped it into the smoker. Everyone thinks beekeepers use smokers to calm the bees. That's not really true. Smoke freaks them out. They think their hive is on fire, so they rush back to fill up on honey and carry it safely away. It only calms them because they're too busy making a slow getaway to bother with you. I walked slowly towards my house, with a smoker in hand, ready to give it a few pumps if the bees started focusing on me. So far, so good. I made it all the way up the long driveway to my front door without incident. Once I unlocked the door and stepped inside, a shudder ran through all the bee letters. By the time I'd locked the door, they had broken formation and were a huge, loose cloud patrolling the yard. After 2 days of getting dressed up in my bee suit every time I went into the yard, I was getting seriously worried. The bees kept spelling different messages. I was grateful they were in the backyard, buzzing, "Dick face," when the police were in the front yard asking me about finding Ellen's body. They were initially very curious about why she'd come to see her ex-boyfriend on the day she died. Well, so was I. They lost interest in Ellen, and in me, soon enough. It turned out she'd had an aneurysm. Being a suspect had made me angry. Now I was just numb. The bees were probably going hungry. I hadn't seen them visit their hive or any flowers in days, and they only had so much reserve strength. This year's honey crop was going to tank. If they didn't start collecting nectar soon, there wouldn't be enough honey to last them through the winter, much less any extra for me to extract and sell. I wanted to put out some sugar water, just to help them keep their strength up, but did I want weeks of being insulted by my bees? On the other hand, if I let them die, I'd have to order a new batch of workers and a queen, and it would take years to get as big as this colony. After 2 days of stalemate, I couldn't avoid work any longer. I'd used up what bereavement leave I could get. I walked to my car in my bee suit, got in, and started to drive away. The second the car began to move, the bees were all over it, crawling on the roof, all over the side mirrors and passenger windows. The front and back windows remained clear of bees, though, so I could still see pretty well. I could park, run back into the house and hide, if they didn't get me once I opened the car door. Or I could drive to work and pretend that I wasn't being haunted by the swarm. So I drove to work. Once I hit the city proper, I got honked at constantly. And no wonder. The skin of my car looked like it was coming alive. I was half wishing my car was white, too, but I was getting sick of hiding. I parked and shed my bee suit, then opened the door slowly, not wanting to squish any bees. They took flight, hovering just above the car's surface. As I stepped out, I could hear them close behind me. I turned around. 2 feet behind me was me. Well, an exact model of me, 6'1", long arms and skinny as a rake, formed of bees. Thousands of beating wings and compound eyes were fixated on me. After a second, the bee me turned its head and looked over its left shoulder, too. Oh, God. The thought of being followed by a bee shadow all day was excruciating. Maybe I could lose him. The door to get inside was automatic. I walked up to it and stopped a foot away. The door slid open, but I stayed motionless. I checked over my shoulder again. Other than checking over their shoulder and beating their wings to stay in place, the bees stayed motionless, too. I took a huge step, then threw the open door just to the far edge of the weight-sensing mat, then stopped. I checked again. The bee shadow had stopped just before the open door. The door slid closed, shutting them outside. Yes! I indulged in a stuck-out tongue of triumph at the bee shadow. Too far, it dissolved in an angry buzzing, all the bees dropping low as though their shape was melting. Soon they were all crawling over the sensor mat. The door wouldn't budge, though. It was meant for people, mostly adults, and there was no way to be heavy enough. I left the frustrated bees on the mat and headed to my cubicle. I'd had a fairly productive morning, made a few sales over the phone and had one woman threaten to sue, and decided to grab a coffee from the cafeteria. My mind kept drifting back to the bees outside. Could they damage my car? There was no way they could pierce the tires. The worst thing I could come up with was flying in through the exhaust, but that seemed like a suicide mission. Ellen didn't know much about cars, anyway. When I got back to my cubicle, there were bees on my chair, my headset, and my computer monitor. I jerked and spilled coffee on my shoes on the carpet. I realized what I should have been worried about. What happens when someone else goes through that door? I went to sit down, but the bees on the seat of my chair stayed motionless, calling my bluff. I stayed standing. Caroline, my boss, noticed my head protruding from the top of the cubicle and took it as a cue to come over. Her eyes widened at the bees. Jim, what's going on here? Are those wasps alive? Well, these are my honeybees, and, they followed me to work. Pest control! She screamed. Stop it! I whispered as loud as I could. I'll get them out of here. You know Tara's allergic, Caroline whispered back. You want us to get sued out of existence? She yelled again. Emergency! 911! I saw my coworker standing up, looking over their cubicles. Panicking, I sprinted to the communal fridge and grabbed a can of Coke. I cracked it open. I poured the pop slowly over my head, getting it in my hair and my beard, and then dumped the rest onto the front and back of my shirt. It was cold and sticky and smelled like sugar. Perfect. The bees started buzzing. Some started to fly towards me. Okay, bees, Ellen, whatever, you're coming with me now, because I'm sugary sweet and fucking irresistible. And just like that, I was covered in them. Some guys do this bee-beard stunt, where they put a caged queen bee under their chin and hundreds of bees crawl on them to get to her. I've never wanted to do that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love my bees, but I like having a veil between me and them. Now they were buzzing and crawling right on me, licking the sticky coke off my skin. I had to move fast, to leave before they got bored of the coke. I stood up slowly. I didn't want to startle them. I was so concerned about the bees' feelings that I had forgotten about everyone else in the office. Tara came out of the washroom and immediately started screaming, "Oh God, what is that? It's wasps! It's a wasp man! Oh God, you know I'm allergic to wasps!" "Tara? Tara, it's cool. It's me, Jim. The bees and I are leaving." I tried to sound calm, but I was worried one of the bees might crawl into my mouth while I was talking. She just kept shaking her head spasmodically. I walked outside. It had started to rain. I was getting soaked, and the bees were slowly taking off. There were none left on me by the time I got the car door open. "Come on, bees, let's go home." They flew with the car on the ride back, dodging raindrops. When I reached my driveway, I was ready to admit defeat. I couldn't control them. I couldn't control my life with them in it, and I couldn't let them die. In 5 years of beekeeping, I had never had any bees inside my house. This time, I let the swarm follow me inside. We went upstairs, together, to my bedroom. I went to my bookshelf and pulled down the photo of me and Ellen laughing at Sarah and Tim's potluck. I was waiting, bracing myself for the bees to go wild, to fly from behind me and cover the picture frame. But there wasn't a sound. I looked behind me. They were on the floor, barely moving. I knew why Ellen had been in my driveway. She was always trying to figure me out. We both had, said a lot of shitty things to each other in our last fight. I guess it's what made it the last one. I stepped carefully around the bees on the floor. When I got back to the bedroom with a shallow bowl of sugar water, they were still motionless. I resisted the urge to pour it on them to get a reaction. I didn't want their wings to get sticky. I set the bowl down. They didn't move. I was out of ideas. Shit, Ellen, just shit. I wanted to be mad at the bees, at her for being crazy and following me around and insulting me and scaring the crap out of my coworkers. But I wasn't. I'm sorry we never got to get over being spiteful to each other. I'm sorry that things didn't work out, and that I couldn't be who you wanted. Through the blur of tears, I saw some bees rising from the floor. I'm sorry that you died. Not because I wanted us to get back together, but because you didn't deserve it. You're a good person, and you didn't deserve me making you feel like I hated you, because I don't. And once again, they were on me, tiny tongues licking away my tears. They'd wanted salt, not sugar. Some bees still hung in the air, spelling out, "Oh." I don't love you anymore either, though, just for the record. I got back, "Jerk," in reply, but the bees on my face were soothing and calm, and I could almost see Ellen's wink. When I was done crying, I felt exhausted. I sprawled onto my bed, fully clothed. The bees stayed on top of me like a living blanket. There was something familiar about the weight of them on my chest, something I'd been missing. I didn't think that I could fall asleep covered in honeybees, but I must have. In the morning, it was clear that there would be no more bee shadows, no more swears, and no more following me to work. The sugar water was gone, and the bees were everywhere in the house, buzzing around aimlessly. I had to ask two local beekeepers to help me round them all up to bring them back to their hive. "Why did you let them get inside anyway?" one asked, when the house was finally free of bees. "I don't know," I said. I guess I was lonely.